listen to my daddy and my Uncle Jay. Not in a creepy way.
I'm lacking eloquence. Here's the thing that I have the thing about.
I wonder who the bitchy woman was.
You're a bad person.
So she slips in the back door. I am slippery than you, and I don't cock it up.
Lady. Oh no.
You'll end up with your balls in your mouth.
Awkward. I did not see that kind.
So boring. So pedestrian.
That's okay. I like this podcast.
Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about 1991's Dead Again, directed by and starring Kenneth Branagh.
Was he married to Emma Thompson at that point?
I believe they were, yeah.
All right.
Which is surprising to me, but we'll kind of get into there a little bit. I guess let's just start out with one thing that I found odd. Roger Ebert, and more than just Roger Ebert, but Roger Ebert, whose opinion I usually respect and it influences me, he gave this movie 4 stars, like his highest rating.
4 stars is his highest rating?
I believe so.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, or
he gave it 4 stars?
He gave it 4 stars. He said it was Hitchcockian. He said he compared Branagh to Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock in the way he directed this.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe that's in the prism of 1991. I will confess that I think I saw this movie in the theaters and I thought it was a great movie, but upon rewatching it, not to ruin everybody's day, it was a horrible movie.
Well, I don't know about horrible, but it really is weird. I mean, it's got some real flaws to it.
I wrote 2 pages of notes and I think I quit at one point. Because I need to just be zen with this. Because this was a movie that I liked. I should say, I didn't hate this movie upon rewatching it. But boy, I wouldn't give it maybe 2 stars. 3 is overly, overly generous.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought too. I thought it's a solid 2-star movie. You know, it's fine to watch if, you know, nothing else is going on.
Yeah,
but
I would agree.
It's certainly
with that.
Nothing I would put anybody up for an award for.
Well, and so, I mean, the movie opening, I think, was one of the things that really kind of grated on me because it was such a long open because they were trying to give the backstory that it was like major exposition opening, you know?
Exactly. And that's what my first note of the whole thing was a question. And that question is, newspaper clipping exposition opening, staple of noir or hackneyed?
Well, then that's what I was like. I didn't think it was very well done opening, and so it was okay. But it really kind of visually didn't work very well.
Well, and it was 2 hackneyed openings because it was not only a newspaper clipping exposition, but it was also opening with a dream sequence.
The dream sequence, because it had all the prison footage and all that.
Well, I remember at the very end, she wakes up from this dream because he's gonna stab.
God.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So you want to go, let's start with the plot of this movie. By the way, just so anybody listening here, if you want to, since you've hopefully already downloaded the entire podcast, you can actually hit pause. You can go to YouTube and in 10-minute chunks, you can watch the entire movie Dead Again.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. So it's fine. You know, you can watch this at work. You can watch this, you know, you can actually probably stream it if you've got some good data rates, you know, watch it on the commuter train. I don't know. I don't know how you live.
The movie opens with this montage-esque newspaper clippings with a series of the Kenneth Branagh character is an old German composer who is named Roman Strauss, who through some mysterious circumstance murders his wife, who's played by Emma Thompson, the Grace character, who, I think Margaret, right? Margaret Strauss, right, Margaret?
Yes, Margaret Strauss.
Roman and Margaret are married. Through whatever vehicle that they're choosing to open with in this newspaper montage, Margaret's killed. He's put on trial for it, and he's eventually convicted, and then sent to the, he's put to death for it, except, so maybe you can explain this to me. I didn't understand who he stabbed in what woman he stabbed in the opening of the movie.
Well, that's the thing. It's a dream sequence. He's stabbing Margaret, even though Margaret is long dead. So then, Grace.
I don't understand how it was a dream sequence because the newspaper reporter was there.
Okay, here's what I got from it. You start with this series along with the opening credits. We have these newspaper articles detailing this crime in 1949, where you have the pianist Margaret Strauss is stabbed with a pair of antique scissors during an apparent robbery. Now, the anklet that she wore that was worth a bunch of money was missing, and her husband, composer Roman Strauss, Kenneth Branagh, is found guilty of the crime and sentenced to death. So before his execution, and by the way, I'm reading this off of Wikipedia, but before his execution, Roman's visited by reporter Gray Baker. When asked if he called Margaret, Roman leans in to whisper in Gray's ear. Baker doesn't reveal Roman's answer at the time. And then, so Roman takes this long walk where he's palmed the scissors that the barber had used to cut his hair, and he's going to the Green Mile, whatever, the long walk to death row, or to the execution chamber, and at the end of the execution chamber, you see his wife, and he takes the scissors that he has stolen from his cell, and he's going to stab her, and boom, you find out it's a dream sequence, and Grace, it's 40 years later, and Grace, who's Emma Thompson also, wakes up having this horrible dream, and she wakes up in kind of an institution, or how exactly did she get to the orphanage?
Yeah, I don't think they ever explained that. But she just woke up, she was found outside the grounds, and so they brought her in, and then, you know, but she was non-responsive, and they put her out for the night.
Yeah, so she's catatonic, and she's in this orphanage or whatever. Anyway, so she ends up there, and the priest ends up getting a hold of Mike Church, who is a private detective who specializes in finding missing heirs.
With his big GTE sat phone.
I was going to put on the, it's the GTE product placement there. And am I being picky, or did Kenneth Branagh not do a very good American accent?
I didn't think it was terrible, but it wasn't his best work.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just because I knew that was a problem.
But Emma Thompson's accent wavered in and out, too.
True. Yeah. Everybody, and Robin Williams, spoiler, his accent wavers in and out, too.
Yeah.
What we have now is a basic, like, typical noir story. We've got this hard-boiled detective, kind of, although he kind of plays it. At one point, I wrote down in my notes, is this a comedy? Because there's a lot of weird, I don't know. He's got this twinkle in his eye like he's not taking anything very seriously.
It was very wacky.
And yet it's not a wacky story at all. It's a noir story. It's a thriller story.
I think they were trying to play it, and this may have been the era, in that crazy, zany moonlighting kind of way.
Maybe. And, you know, one of the things that Ebert and some other reviewers said was that this is all very theatrical because, of course, Kenneth Branagh is, you know, from the stage.
Okay.
But I don't think that compensates for a kind of
this
weird wackiness.
Did you really think this was very theatrical?
No. No.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And I don't actually think, contrary to, a bunch of reviews at the time, I don't think there was really any chemistry between the two people who are in real life married to each other.
No, I didn't think so either.
It was a strange deal. And she plays the whole thing as really one note.
Yeah.
I mean, she's basically catatonic through most of the show.
She's cold and distant through the whole movie.
Yeah. Anyway, so now we are in present day, which is 1989, roughly. And anyway, so Mike Church, Kenneth Branagh, now, is asked to investigate the identity of this woman who he ends up naming Grace. She suffers from violent nightmares. She has amnesia and she's not able to speak at all. So he takes her in, which is, you know, kind of, I mean, there is a nice scene where he tries to take her to the mental hospital, and the mental hospital was just horrific. So he ended up taking her home. And I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. I think it was a little over dramatic for being a state hospital, but I also wrote, this is where I wrote one of my first notes. She's catatonic. That's really where they're going to take her, though?
Well, yeah, I don't know. They might. I mean, because it's not a physical problem. It's a psychological problem. And historically, there weren't really very many choices. Although, again, this maybe it's kind of a dated choice because what with, in our current system, I don't think, unless she was just unable to care for herself, she'd even be put in such a facility.
Right.
So now we have the duo of Mike and Grace. And then Wayne Knight, who plays Wayne Knight.
See, I wrote down in Kepler's Newman.
Of course. So he's going to publish her picture in the newspaper along with contact information, right? That's the way you get it done. Put your picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then they are approached by Franklin Madsen, who's Derek Jacobi.
I want to interrupt you just a moment here. So they have the night in the apartment together in New. Maybe I'm out of sequence a little bit, but at one point they're in the apartment together. They're in Mike's apartment. And at one point, like, there's this thing, and he's washing her hair, and that's when I wrote, oh, this is a bad movie.
Well, you know, when you're amnesiac with bad dreams, you get the oily, you know, hair, and you gotta strip all that bad stuff off of there.
Oh, and so that is before the little hypnotist dude comes in.
Yeah, the little hypnotist dude.
Which I actually thought was an interesting plot point. The little thievish hypnotist relic hunter. I thought that that was actually kind of a brilliant plot.
Oh, yeah.
Device.
No, I thought too. I thought it was a good character. And it was, you know, since we're going with this whole wacky theme, that makes a certain amount of sense. You know?
Yeah.
It actually gives him a little bit of credibility, because the fact that they believe that he's a medium is, or a hypnotist, sorry, is, I don't know. They seem to buy that pretty easily. But hey, if it works. And also, a bit of my notes that Derek Jacobi plays Franklin Madsen as Roddy McDowell.
Absolutely.
I totally thought, every time he talked, I was like, oh, this is just Roddy McDowell.
He's channeling Roddy McDowell.
Yeah.
But I also wrote immediately after that, scissors, scissors, scissors just can't be subtle.
Oh, no. No, there. And we're going to get to that a little bit later because, oh, my God, this movie is not subtle. It has twists to it. It has twists to it. Don't get me wrong. It actually has some twists. And if you want a Saturday afternoon movie, or if you're convalescing or something, that's fine. This isn't going to stress your brain.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we just immediately go to hypnosis to figure out what's going on. At first, the hypnosis doesn't work right, but then they try past life regression, which is also, again, they take this, like, okay, I guess, why not? So all of a sudden, Grace starts talking about this whole Margaret and Roman thing in the 40s. So we have even more exposition there. Madsen then pulls out a mysterious copy of Life magazine from the time of the murder and shows them all these people, and they look exactly like, you know, Mike and Grace. So we have an eerie connection between the two of them anyway from a past life.
A very strange kind of parallel.
Yeah. So then how does Mike go? Well, how does he end up talking to Cozy Carlisle? We will know him as Robin Williams.
Well, we see him foreshadowed earlier, but I think before he meets, because the first place he goes to before he meets Emma Thompson, the Grace character, he goes to the grocery store where Robin Williams works to give him, you know, hey, we found some money from one of your patients that died.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't even put that together.
Yeah, so that's the first thing Mike does before he gets the beeper, by the way, the beeper call. He has a cell phone, but they don't call him on it. They've used a beeper.
Of course. You know how expensive it would be to make a GTE call?
So that's how you get him with the Robin Williams character to begin with. So that's how they're introduced.
Well, we've got Robin Williams, who, the whole thing, I thought he was just a doctor, but Wikipedia insisted he's a disgraced psychiatrist. Do they explain why he's disgraced?
You didn't pay any attention to that part.
Apparently not.
The whole exposition of the first part when Mike initially meets him is that he had slept with a few clients. And, you know, yes, he cared for them, but that was no reason for him to have to lose his license. So there was major exposition there. But it was like way overshare, and it was clear and clunky that Robin Williams was going to come up again.
Well,
this wasn't just like a mere cameo. This was like clearly, it was so clearly telegraphed.
Well, maybe I was distracted by something, but I didn't even realize it was Robin Williams at first until he has this scene where he comes and kind of consults in the meat locker.
The meat locker.
Yeah, weren't they in the meat locker the first time? Or was that
in the first
second?
Time?
Yeah,
in the very first time, because that's when he has the whole speech, you know, either you're a smoker or you're not.
Oh, yeah, okay, got it. And that was before he met Grace?
Yes.
Okay, I guess you're right. So Cozy Carlisle becomes sort of a confidant and a contributor of strange advice and snappy dialogue.
Right.
And it doesn't, again, it's very clunky. Like, he ends up calling him a thumb dick at one point. I actually have something I'll drop in later saying actually a pretty funny line about karma. But
yeah, one of my favorite lines of any movie, by the way.
Oh yeah, no, it's good. It's a good. It's a definitely. It's worth watching the whole movie just to get that line about karma that I will spoil for everybody because I will drop it in because it's too great. Yeah, not to
well,
share.
But for your edification, that line was used in the previews that was played to everybody, which is why people went and saw it. Even though that line has almost nothing to do with the movie.
No, not at all. In fact, his advice is dubious.
No, he strips clients.
Well, he also is, his morality is maybe not up to the standards that you would want in a typical movie hero.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to go to him for moral advice.
You wouldn't want to go to him for advice in general.
Well, maybe about what cut of meat to buy.
Perhaps.
He does work at the grocery store. Anyway, he encourages Mike to keep going and getting all these sessions with Madison, the hypnotist. Because, of course, he ends up like believing in a lot of metaphysics and stuff, even though he is supposed to be a psychiatrist. So then Mike and Grace fall in love.
Yeah.
And they're all of a sudden she's wearing his sweater. They're going to go out and have a good time. They'll be fun. And then a mysterious man named Doug appears and claims that Grace is his fiancée, Catherine.
Yes. And for those of you playing the home game who watch possibly cable television might recognize this man in a very dated fashion. In today's world, he actually is on a television show currently.
Which television show?
Royal Pains.
Yeah.
Plays Boris.
Is that a good show?
It's a decent show. I started watching it after like the second or third season because it started to grate on my nerves. It had Henry Winkler briefly off and on, but that also kind of got on my nerves. Of the things that I was choosing to waste my DVR space on, it fell off of the things I needed to continue to watch.
Ah, yeah, that happens to me.
Not a terrible show, but just like. It lost. It's like it was like bubblegum. The flavor went out of it very quickly.
Isn't it like a sort of a primetime soap opera doctor show in Rich People?
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of Hamptons. Poor doctor, disgraced, ends up in the Hamptons treating rich people. Concierge doctor, I think is what the premise.
Oh, well.
So they meet Doug, who turns out through some trickery, Doug isn't really what he appears to be. And so we embark upon the most constipated running face ever.
Oh, yeah.
It is the worst, most like horrible. Like, I had to stop the movie because I could not control myself. I could not stop laughing because it was the most ridiculous, over-the-top, crazy-faced. It looked like Kenneth Branagh was going to squirt his guts out of his nostrils.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You wonder if he's maybe like a heavy smoker or something and just couldn't maintain that pace.
It's almost worth it just to watch that part of the movie just because it was so ridiculously crazy. It really didn't have any point in being in this movie.
The Doug character does nothing but sort of snap you in back into the reality that these people can't really fall in love. I mean, they shouldn't.
And then immediately I wrote, again with the scissors, in exclamation mark.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, scissors, scissors, scissors.
Oh, but we haven't
just
even...
can't get away from the scissors.
We have not begun to discuss scissors yet. So, and then we start getting, as we go through more sessions with Roddy McDowall, we end up seeing more about Roman and Margaret Strauss. And, okay, as far as I'm concerned, Branagh plays Roman Strauss as John Malkovich.
That's probably a fair comparison.
But, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's all very dramatic and stagey at this point when they go flashback to 1949. Because you're getting little pieces of the murder mystery because we don't know whether Roman killed Margaret or not. But Grace is pretty sure that somebody is still out to get her or something.
She thinks she's still in active peril.
So,
which is not in any way undercut by the crazy medium psychic relic hunter.
So anyway, under hypnosis, she recalls that things were not all bright and shiny in the world of Roman and Margaret. Because Roman can't finish his opera and they're in debt. And she had no idea how in debt they were. And yet, even though they're in debt, he won't get rid of his creepy housekeeper, Inga, and her creepy boy, Frankie, because they helped Roman escape the Nazis. In the middle of this, we get Gray Baker, who's this reporter guy who's trying to make his moves on Margaret in a none-too-subtle Andy Garcia fashion. I don't like Andy Garcia. I'm sorry.
I don't dislike him, but I gotta say, he had the awfully best voice box of any stoma patient I've ever experienced.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that. I thought
especially
that was...
considering this was the 90s.
Well, exactly. There's that. And as far as I was concerned, like I said, Adrian Brody should have played the Andy Garcia role. So when I recast this, it's going to be John Malkovich, Roddy McDowall, Adrian Brody.
Okay. So I'm going to make you. I'm going to force you to complete this. Then who would be the Strauss characters?
Obviously, John Malkovich is Roman Strauss, and Margaret Strauss. It could be Emma Thompson. That's fine. There's no reason not to continue to have her work. By the way, old Inga. When we meet Inga as an old woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Voight. I'm just saying.
Oh, why are you going to be like that?
I'm going to find two pictures and put them together because it's amazing.
Oh,
so
you're a bad man.
Of course. Anyway, at this point, the score is super dramatic. Oh my God, this is all melodrama.
Oh, it's like turn to 11.
So let's see, where are
they? They're trying to wring every last hanky out they can because they know that these are going to be tears of you having spent money on this movie.
So Grace finally has a vision of Mike in the bath standing over Margaret with a pair of scissors and is terrified, convinced that he means to kill her. So Mike is like, hey, I'm not Roman. I don't know why. I would never hurt you, you know. But then he accidentally calls her Margaret. So she flips out. And then he agrees to be regressed as well under hypnosis. And here's the first big turn. Under hypnosis, Mike discovers he's actually Margaret in the past. And Grace was Roman.
Yeah, and that was the first big plot twist that I forgot. Because there's two big plot twists that I was like, oh, I forgot that one. And I actually wrote, I forgot the big plot twist. And then I wrote, I forgot the big plot twist times two.
Yeah, well, this is the first one. And so now we know, we've got twists and turns ahead, maybe. So so now we have it. Now we have this an opportunity now that Mike is super confused because he's actually Margaret in the past. He ends up going back to see Robin Williams. And this is when the quote comes in.
So, like, you know, what happens now?
Fucking do her, man. Blow her away.
What?
One shot. Right here.
You telling me to kill her?
You do her before she does you.
I thought karma was like you learned something from one lifetime to another.
Well, that's what you learned from this life. I mean, karmically, self-defense is quite cool.
I love the quote. The karma quote is great.
I laughed out loud.
Because you definitely don't expect it, because at this point it's sort of a tender kind of thing. You still have this little tenderness going on. Yeah. But anyway, Newman shows up and said that, hey, we know who Grace is. Her name's really Amanda, and she's an artist. Okay? This is, I just wrote down, when we go and find Amanda's apartment, I just wrote down, batshit crazy scissors artist.
Yes.
I also wrote that gigantic shiny scissor sculpture. Oh, we're never going to see that again. That's not going to become an important plot point later. I was like, oh, come on. You cannot show a gigantic scissor sculpture within a scissors palace in the first act without having somebody stabbed with it in the final act. And that,
it was like so ridiculously over the top. They were so trying to, you know what? I would have expected some. This movie would have done with some subtlety. It would have been done so much better with just a little subtlety.
That's the thing. You're absolutely right. Subtlety is what this movie lacked.
Yes. If it would have just been a lot more probably subtle, it would have been an infinitely better movie. Like, the scissors make an appearance once. But at the point that they're in his apartment fighting, like, where he's giving her the scissors, like, they're having this huge fight, and he's, like, giving her all the scissors because she's afraid. I'm like, really? You are ridiculous. Like, you've chosen poorly. But there's so many places in this movie where they could have just made subtle allusions, or they could have just, like, once or twice with the scissors. But the whole studio full of scissors with the blades and I'm sorry, I must have been asleep. I didn't know this movie was about scissors in any way.
Oh, the apartment is so great full of scissors. Oh, man, there are thousands of little scissors everywhere. Yeah, this is not her name,
like,
should have been.
It's like somebody at Staples or Office Depot got a contract or something.
Oh, whoever put together her office, whoever was the set designer for her apartment, probably had a field day. Or either that or Kenneth Branagh was like, okay, and put scissors everywhere, but make sure there's a gigantic shiny pair of scissors right there in the center of the whole set so that no one will miss it, because it's important later. If we need to shine an extra light on that, make sure that you get that. J.J. Abrams would have had lens flare come off of that scissor sculpture.
Yes, he would have. But there also would have been, like, exploding scissors from the ceiling.
Well, there's that, too. But okay, so basically we have Newman and Roddy McDowell escorting Grace back to her scissors apartment because she's still scared of Mike. Mike ends up going, and after he talks to Corky or whatever his name is, who says, ice the bitch. He ends up, during this whole thing, Amanda's super scared of Mike, so Roddy McDowell gives her an antique gun from his antique shop to use as protection. So that's great. And then, so Mike goes and hunts out the first of the two old people we meet, and that's Gray Baker, the reporter. So Gray Baker, it's from the very beginning, he talks about how he's such a heavy smoker, and now he's, of course, he's got a stoma, and he uses a voice box to talk. But I thought this was some of the worst age makeup I've ever seen. The worst. The stoma effect was cool. The rest of his face is horrible.
Well, he's a cancer patient.
No, but I mean, the whole thing is just poor. I don't think they did a good job at all.
You know, you work with what you got.
I guess. But yeah, I did think that the stoma effect where he ends up smoking a cigarette through his stoma is pretty great. Mike ends up asking Baker, you know, what happened? What did he whisper in his ear? The whole thing. And then Baker says he didn't whisper anything in my ear. He just kissed me.
With the strangest kind of homoerotic, bizarre, kind of batshit crazy movie antics.
But it goes nowhere. Is it just a red herring? I mean, it just goes nowhere.
Yes.
Although he does give Mike one piece of advice, and that's go see Inga. So he goes and tracks down the old Inga.
Right.
Well, actually, I guess based on his description, Mike realizes that Franklin Madison is Inga's son, Frankie. And at first, I actually, in my notes, I put, oh my God, is Mike Frankie?
Yeah, see, that's where I wrote, oh, I forgot the second plot twist.
Yeah, but no. Let's see. Oh, lots of congos in the score toward the end. There's congos and bongo drums like crazy at the end.
Yeah.
But oh dear, the big shiny pair of scissors art showed up. Melodrama, melodrama, melodrama.
And then I wrote, slow-mo is bad for all of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway.
Slow-mo doesn't help anyone in this movie.
No, not at all. So now we have the conclusion of everything where Mike realizes that Madison is Frankie. Mike questions Inga and explains that there's this whole love triangle, and Frankie blamed Margaret for his mother's unhappiness and killed her with the scissors. And then Roman stumbled upon the scene and was found later covered in his wife's blood holding the murder weapon. So, also, Frankie, Inga's child, had a horrible stammer. He stuttered like crazy, so he ended up going, she sent him to London to get professional help from, hello, a hypnotherapist. And then he discovered, of course, past life regression, because hypnosis and past life regression go together like peas and carrots. And then he became convinced that Margaret's spirit would seek revenge. So I guess that's what he was been reading the paper for 40 years, to find the picture of the woman that looked exactly like. I mean, how does that even work?
I don't know.
Is there only 500 different faces in the world, and everybody just reincarnates into their own, to the next one? There's no new faces.
That was never clearly explained.
So anyway, so Inga apologizes for keeping it all a secret, and says she's not going to protect Frankie anymore. But of course, dun dun dun, Frankie is there, and yeah, so he kills Mom
with a pillow.
With a pillow, of course.
Yeah.
He should have killed her with scissors also, but oh well.
See, I was just going to say that. I know. Why do you got to kill her with the pillow? That was subtle.
So then we get the last crescendo, the denouement. No, it's not. It's the climax. It's the climax coming up. It's Mike races to the apartment when he figures out that, oh no, Grace is actually with the bad guy all along. And I had forgotten that Newman was there with them too.
Well, Newman shows up with a pizza.
Exactly, and I wrote my notes. I'm like, how did Newman...
Inexplicably, by the way.
No, it, you know, it turns out he and Roddy McDowell went together with her to the apartment. So it kind of makes sense that he came back with pizza, but there probably should have been some real quick scene where he says, hey, I'm going to go for pizza. Because yeah. He does seem to just appear with keys to the house.
Yep.
So there's this, Mike bursts in to save Grace. Grace doesn't know he's there to save her, so she shoots him. And then Madison arrives. He rips off his monster mask and shows his true self. And then she tries to shoot him with the gun, but the gun jams. I thought maybe he only loaded it with one bullet or something, but anyway. So then Madison knocks her out. He places the scissors in Mike's hand to make it look like... Oh, he right. tries to make it look like...
Well, because he's going to make it look like a murder-suicide.
My guess. Like...
Because, you know, because she's been shot, and then, you know, there's going to be some stabbing. Like, he was trying to stab her with the scissors, but she shot him, and then she is so despondent that she shot him that she shoots herself.
But, of course, as he's trying to pull the trigger on her, Mike stabs Roddy McDowell in the leg with the scissors.
Right.
And then
he's
in this horrible... I'm reading again from Wikipedia. In this ensuing struggle, Madison is impaled on a sculpture with giant scissors and dies. Okay, that simple sentence does not give you the full sense of the scene at the end where there's this big fight. And then, I swear to God, it's like a tombstone moment where Madison is just like no! And
well, the ridiculousness of the Mike Church character, like, clearly moving this whole apparatus into place just for him to fall on it.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
It was so ridiculous. It was so ridiculous. It was, like, it'd be one thing if he'd, like, clumsily fallen on it, and I'd forgotten that part of the movie, clearly, because I would have stopped it before I re-saw this point of the movie. Because I can't unsee it now for the second time. Now it's just etched in my head. No, there's even less subtlety now. There is even...
Oh, no. It's a total... It's complete, like, television movie acting at the end. I mean, this is with the slow-mo with him and the scissors.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Like, he was trying to line up the shot.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
It's like... you couldn't have been more creative. I mean, and also, I know that maybe I'm a little critical, but maybe you should have killed him without scissors, and that would have been a nice plot twist.
Well, yeah, yeah.
To break the cycle.
Well, there is a dead again, too.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah, there definitely is. I don't know much about it. I don't even know if it involves the characters,
boy.
But I'm pretty sure there's a dead again, too.
Okay.
We're not going discuss that on the podcast.
Not this one, anyway.
No, definitely. Well, anyone, as far as I'm concerned. There's no reason for me to see Dead Again, too. Unless it's followed with a colon and electric boogaloo.
That would be awesome.
It would be. That's what this lacked. Dancing.
No, there was dancing.
No, there was dancing, but not hip-hop dancing with bicycles.
No. Flavor Flav was probably busy. Flavor Flav, sorry.
I think electric... Let's see, Breaking 2. I want to say Jean-Claude Van Damme has a cameo in that. Or not a cameo, he's just a background actor.
I'm frightened that that's even in your head somewhere.
It's in my head, but I don't know how true it is. I'm going to have to find out. But
well, like all good things, everything in your head is, you know, it's better not knowing sometimes.
Well, it is what it is. I mean, that's, you know, it's like I'm not going to be able to change it in the next 2 minutes. But yeah, so... Overall, Judge Jason, can you render your judgment?
This movie is guilty of lacking subtlety.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm going to say an aggravating factor is that is melodrama up the yin-yang.
Yeah, this movie should probably be executed.
Oh, I think that's a little harsh.
Well, so I don't know. I mean, again, it wasn't the worst movie I've seen. It's certainly not the worst movie we've reviewed. At least not in my opinion.
Oh, well, clearly not. No, not at all. This was actually not even, this wasn't even like hard to watch or a chore or anything. It was just sadly absurd in parts.
Right. Ridiculous. It was just ridiculously over the top where it didn't need to be and could have been a better movie had they just backed up a little bit. I'm wondering if this was Kenneth Branagh, if he was just a young producer and or director, whatever he was. It makes you wonder.
He'd already done Henry V by this time.
Yeah, but that's a very different kind of. There's not a lot of interpretation to Henry V.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I mean, I don't. I'm not articulating myself well. The story is the story, and so you have a little bit of kind of nuance, but the story is the story. This there because it was a new story, because you know this isn't really a story that I'd seen before. This isn't a retelling. This is his interpretation of the screenplay through the film. And I think that I wonder how his youth or, inexperience kind of led to this way over the top kind of performance. I may be over apologizing for him for no good reason. But.
Here is what they said at the time about this movie, or what Kenneth Branagh said at the time. He said at the time of this making of this film, this comes from IMDb, the trivia, he was very interested in the technique of uninterrupted takes. And you can see several through the movie. The first hypnosis sequence, The Laughing Duke, which features an extremely complicated camera shot in 360 degrees, which involved precise timing and technical faculty. He said that this short scene was shot about 15 times, taking a whole day. So
he's really up his own ass.
A little bit, yeah. He's trying to do... I think that's probably why you get the Orson Welles... and Hitchcock, because it had kind of a Hitchcock thing. It's a noir thing, so it fills up the Hitchcock thing. And it also had, like, he's going for, you know, camera angles and very precise shooting. So that's Orson Welles and Hitchcock, actually. But he also, they had a lot of fun making this movie, Branagh and the gang.
Did they? Because that chemistry didn't come across.
Well, no, not necessarily he and M. Thompson had any fun. But I guess a date on one of the newspaper clippings is actually Branagh's birthday. And Roman Strauss's prisoner number is the date of the Battle of Agincourt, which is...
Battle of Agincourt, really?
Agincourt, yeah, that's from Henry V. So.
Oh, God. So not much subtlety there either.
Branagh has combined all these cinematic elements into an achievement that rivals Hitchcock's best work and stands out as one of the most intriguing and memorable thrillers of the 1990s.
Yeah. No.
That is... I just disagree. That's Patrick Doyle's... Hold on. Who is this? Yeah, that's Roger Ebert. It's crazy.
No. Yeah. No. No. No.
But even the lukewarm reviews, it says... Vincent Canby of New York Times says, it's a big, convoluted, entertainingly dizzy romantic mystery melodrama. Dead Again is eventually a lot simpler than it pretends to be. The explanation of the mystery is a rather commonplace letdown, but probably nothing short of mass murder could successfully top the Baroque buildup. In this way, too, the film is faithful to his antecedents while still being a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't...
Even a lot of fun is kind of overdoing it. I mean, it was fine.
I think so, too. I think, but again, and I'm not defending any of that. I'm not defending this in any way. I'm just saying, at the time, because of where this movie was made in time, perhaps this hadn't been as tired and overplayed in terms of ridiculousness, not in terms of story. So I wonder if people were just being generous at the time because they thought Kenneth Branagh was up and coming and Emma Thompson was up and coming and this was something kind of not seen before in this kind of method-ish.
Yeah, I think you're right. No, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that you see Branagh and Thompson as these really strong actors, their first kind of filmic roles or whatever, their, you know, his first directing or at least one of his first directing things. So they brought too much. Maybe they got, they graded on a curve because of who they were. And maybe we're just harsher critics these days than back then. But maybe not. I don't know. I still think Ebert got this one wrong.
Well, and again, I have to confess, like I said, I thought this movie was a good movie when I saw it. So clearly I have advanced my movie tastes, and probably, I'm guessing, Ebert did so as well. So I wonder if, like I said, at the time, I think we thought it was a good movie, we being the collective public, or we were duped into it, because maybe we hadn't seen a lot of movies in this style, and certainly there's been movies like this that have been better done since then. But even at the time, I would have never compared this to a Hitchcock flick.
Oh, no. No, never.
Not even, I mean, these aren't even in the same hemisphere as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's aspiring, I think, to be Hitchcockian, but I never had a gasp or a heart-racing moment in this movie when I rewatched it. And there have been very few Hitchcock movies where even on a rewatch that they don't get me. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, and just look at Malice. Malice was a much better movie. I mean, for all its flaws, Malice was a much better movie than this.
Well, it was better acted.
Well, I think it also had a better story.
There was some better chemistry between the actors.
Yeah, absolutely.
On screen. There was some better tension. The plot didn't kind of clod along like this. This seemed to me to be very slow in parts.
Yeah. Well, and okay.
Painfully. Only because of the purpose of it needed just to explain everything. Have more scissors.
Well, the fact that at the end of it, Frankie ends up reverting back to his old stuttery self, that was so Angela Lansbury, Murder, She Wrote. That's totally a Murder, She Wrote sort of thing. Yeah. This could have been an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
We could have, except they wouldn't have had as many scissors.
the scissor budget would have been smaller exactly. On the TV project. No, I'm glad we reviewed it, but yeah, it's. I think we're going to have to go for something a little more ambitious next time.
Well, this will be one of those that I won't ever watch ever again, probably, in my lifetime.
Yeah, me too. I can see that.
And like Malice, I would probably watch again in another 10, 15 years.
Sure.
I mean, depending. Just because it has a great Alec Baldwin speech that my younger brother disagrees with.
Oh, no. I think he believes it's a good speech. He just much prefers the Glenn Ross speech.
Yeah.
Different things, though. Apples and oranges. That's what I have to say about
that. Yeah. I will have to. All right.
And I don't want to be singing the praises of Alec Baldwin too much, because I think probably personally he's something of a jackass, but...
Yeah, but I don't watch... Are we done with the movie?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to come too far off the rails before we've totally murdered this movie. Alec Baldwin, I don't watch movies because of the actor themselves. I watch the movie because of the actor's skills, because I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan... But I'll watch Tom Cruise movies, and I like Tom Cruise movies in spite of him being in them. But I don't boycott him because Tom Cruise is in it. Alec Baldwin is probably not the best human being in the world, but I think he's a good actor, and so I watch him because I find him entertaining.
Oh, I agree completely.
And so I'm always interested when I hear people say, oh, I just can't stand that guy. I'm like, well, you don't have to stand the guy. You just have to like his ability to act.
Oh, exactly,
You know, I'm like, I'm not going to watch a movie because of somebody's politics. I'm going to watch a movie because they can act.
Well, that brings us to a sticky problem with Woody Allen.
I'm not a big Woody Allen fan. So, I've never thought that he was the genius that people make him out to be. And maybe I'm not intellectual enough to get the joke, or I was raised in an environment where his humor just doesn't hit my funny bone, but the only Woody Allen movie that's ever even remotely made me laugh was What's Up, Tiger Lily, which is just ridiculous on the face and the premise.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, there are a lot of really good Woody Allen movies, but again, I actually find it pretty easy to, and even Roman Polanski. I mean, Roman Polanski's something of a monster, and he had horrible things happen to him as a child and as a married man. But it still means, you know, still the fact remains that he's something of a monster. So I don't have any problem with him not being allowed in America anymore. But on the other hand, if he continues to make movies overseas, I probably will watch them. I mean, I guess it's not really, it's probably, I guess, bad to give him money just on principle. But he's not Hitler either.
As much as it's noble to think you're not giving any money, he doesn't need your money.
Well, that's true. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you not seeing the movie because you think you're keeping him from money isn't going to do anything to hurt him.
Well, comedian Dave Anthony, who has a podcast called Walking the Room, actually has another podcast called The Dollop, but I've never listened to that. He actually is a writer on Mark Maron's show, and one day they pranked him by suggesting, I think he might be the head writer even too, but they suggested that that Maron wanted Mike Tyson on, and they did a whole script with Mike Tyson being one of the characters. And Dave Anthony is like, oh, I refuse to be in the same room with Mike Tyson. I don't want him on my show. I don't want to be around him. The man is a rapist, and he keeps showing up in comedies. So, you know, anyway, they pranked him all the way up until he had to basically agree to appear with Mike Tyson in a scene. And he did a lot of hand-wringing and stuff, thinking it was a real deal. And then until they let him off the hook, that Tyson was never even considered for the part.
That would make me evaluate my coworkers.
Again, comedians are funny, but they're not always they're not always very nice.
Well, that's most certainly true, just from listening to other podcasts. So,
oh yeah,
not that I would ever listen to any other podcast than ours, but
oh no, I recommend everybody listen to as many podcasts as they can. Just remember where, you know, remember the little guys need your help too. Although again, I guess, you know, the number of listeners makes me happy, but it doesn't actually change what we're doing. You know, we have a relatively small audience right now, but even if it was 10 times or 100 times what it is now, we'd still be talking about the same stuff.
And for those of you who are downloading 2001 at 5 and 6 times, if you need help, please let us know. Not that we don't love the numbers and volume, but well, if you need help, let us know.
I don't know how Libsyn does their statistics, because you would think that they would automatically not include, you know, like double IPs and stuff like that. You know, who knows? I mean, a download is a download, right?
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, there's no way I'm paying for more comprehensive metrics, because, you know, this is already, it's already a losing money endeavor. There's no way I want to, as much as I love to obsess about numbers, I'm just happy.
I was going
to
say, I'm surprised your crazy metric head hasn't already imploded from that.
Oh, no, I'm happy to have the map on the wall that has the arrows to every country we've talked to. Or
can you get IP-specific metric?
No. Well, you can, just not through Libsyn. And, or if you can, maybe you have to pay extra for it. But there are companies that do that. And it has to do with monitoring your feed. And it also, like, places like Stitcher Radio. Stitcher Radio is great, except they download a copy of your podcast and stream it off of their server, so you never get their numbers. They also put ads on it, which is, you know, whatever, it's fine. I mean, I agreed to that in the terms of service, but I could see where places like The Nerdist would be like, I don't think that's a good idea. Yeah, like with iTunes, iTunes doesn't do anything but point people to where the podcasts are. Like, iTunes doesn't host anything. So, you know, we get, there's plenty of numbers that come from Libsyn through iTunes because it's just a conduit. Stitcher is more than a conduit. But, hey, they're a business too.
I had no idea.
Yep.
Yeah.
What else? I had written a note about the movie.
About this movie?
Okay, so I guess the note I wrote down was one of the things that this movie addresses is, or asks the question, but never answers, is, you know, does fate exist and is life really predestined?
Are you posing that question to me?
I think I am, yeah.
Ask me again.
Okay, this movie kind of plays with the idea that it's all about fate and your life is predestined. So do you believe in predestination or do you believe that you have free will?
I believe a mix of both. I believe that there are certain checkpoints, and I believe there's a certain, I believe there's a certain bit of kismet, of fate, if you will, but I don't believe that everything is set in stone. So I think that there are plenty of potential pieces of fate that you can fall into in your life, but I don't believe that it's absolutely cast, that from the beginning of the dawn of your first breath to your last breath, that everything, no matter what you do, ends up the same way. Did that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah. So I believe we have a mix of free will and fate mixed in, but that our free will can, you know, can determine which of the fates we end up with. And also because if you see now you're getting into the whole Hawking alternate universe, 10-dimension string theory, every possibility that can exist does actually exist and happen all at once. So in my belief of the universe and its fluidity and multiverse, you know, I believe that there is kind of all of these things happening at once. So
fair enough. That's excellent. That's an excellent answer to the question.
Probably more than you were bargaining for.
No. That's actually, well, it was more than I was bargaining for, but not in a bad way. It's more in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. I started with the Bill Bryson book, Brief History of Everything, which I highly recommend, because it's just fascinating and, it's just good brain stuff. Good stuff to just put in your brain and kind of rub around and kind of roll around in. And I also I've got a couple of the Hawking books that I've listened to, which were kind of mind bendingly difficult to comprehend.
Yeah, that's how I felt about the Brief History of Time. It was great,
really?
And the movie was good, but the book...
Well, I didn't know there was a movie.
Well, actually, it's a... it's called A Brief History of Time, and it is... documentary filmmaker, Thin Blue Line... God, I can't remember his name, but he's a famous documentary filmmaker. And it's a really good movie. It's really shot well, and... Most of it is in his computer voice, but it's very well shot. Hey, have you seen The Thin Blue Line?
I have not.
Yeah, that's a movie that actually got somebody off of death row or maybe life in prison. Because Errol Morris, exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I would highly recommend A Brief History of Time and A Thin Blue Line. The Thin Blue Line? Anyway.
The hawk, I got, see, I have the Bill Bryson book. I really dug. I really got that.
Bill Bryson's a good writer. He's got a very nice, style.
And I was lucky enough to get it on Audible.
Audible.com. Ding.
Yeah. I know. Stupid. I give them so many plugs.
Oh, it's okay. I give them plenty of my money. I might as well give them plugs,
too. I do, me too, but I want a free book.
Yeah, wow.
I had a Bill Bryson book, and then I had a couple Hawking books, and the Hawking books, I think the first Hawking book I got through, but was lost, and the second Hawking book I attempted, and then I was like, no. Maybe I'll come back and revisit this in another 10 years when my brain's a little more elastic or full of holes, but no. Can't follow it.
Well, that's how I felt. It was like, I was fine up until the point where he starts to talk about like theoretical math and stuff. And I'm like, okay, this is where I hit my limit. You know, maybe just in the casual way I listen to things. It doesn't, you know, that's not the best setting for this kind of material, but I like the pretty picture in, pretty pictures in, in A Brief History of Time, the movie.
It's a short history of nearly everything. Is what the Bill Bryson book was.
Yeah,
so.
I haven't read it, but I've read the book where he came to America as a foreigner.
Huh.
Because okay. he's an English author. So anyway, thoughts on next week's movie?
I haven't a clue. Do you have any suggestions?
Pretty much anything from your
the list of judgment
would be fine.
And of course, I don't have the list in front of me.
No, I'm trying to think of in my tablet.
Astronomy.
That was fun. I wish we got more time to do that, all three of us. That was fun.
The sneakers? Uh-huh. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the list.
Okay.
I'm not sure what...
Do you have All the President's Men? I'm pretty sure that All the President's Men is within my grasp. So if we want to do that for next week, we certainly can.
We absolutely could.
Okay.
I love that movie, so...
Yeah, let's do that then.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. As always, send feedback to show@notinacreepyway.com. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Hey, write a review. Give us 5 stars. We'd appreciate it. You can also listen on Stitcher Radio. If you have a suggestion for a movie for us to talk about, send it to movie@notinacreepyway.com. We like feedback. We want to hear from you.